This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Normal Town Council candidate Dave Shield says he's satisfied with current management and council representation, but wants to see Uptown development advance even more.
It's a destination, it's lovely, and it's not done yet.
Shields also tells GLT's Mary Cullen the economic development organ VN Advantage is not reaching its full potential. Plus, McLean County Board Chair John McIntyre says video psychiatric services might be the wave of the future. Eric Stock has the interview. The freeze-thaw cycle is bad for roads, but maybe good for gardens. Mike McCurdy and Patrick Murphy grow our knowledge on that. And as people prepare to fly home for the holidays, a former flight attendant recalls air travel the way it used to be from a Next to Normal Story Slam. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There are eight candidates seeking three positions on the Normal Town Council in the municipal contest next April. As part of our election coverage, GLT is inviting all the candidates to sit for interviews. Today, GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with Dave Shields about his priorities and why he's running.
I believe that service is the rent that you pay for the time on earth. I've tried to give back as long as I've lived in town, in big ways, small ways. That volunteerism has kind of given me an opportunity to work closely with the town already in the 2040 Visioning Committee a few years ago, which led to the current comprehensive plan, and which also led to me being named to the Town Planning Commission. So that's another reason, other than the two incumbents, Kathleen Lorenz and R.C. McBride, I have the most experience working with the town already.
All right. Now let's get into some of your priorities if you were to be elected. What exactly do you want to accomplish first off?
Having some skin in the game with the comprehensive plan, I'd like to see the comprehensive plan come to fruition. Of course, everything would be based on the core services that we already have in place being sustained and maintained and improved whenever needed, that the town's finances stay in order, and that everybody who already lives here wants to keep living here. Let's attract and retain folks to Normal.
How would you characterize how the town has been managed over the past decade or so?
I think really well. Mark Peterson is an award-winning town manager, now retired, and Pam Reese has stepped into his shoes quite admirably.
Now, during that time over the past few decades, what do you think about what's been done in Uptown?
I think it's a great success. Even people who I've talked to 10 or so years ago were not such a fan of Uptown have now come around to saying, yeah, I was wrong. This looks great. And it is iconic. It's known throughout the country for civic improvement. It's a destination. It's lovely. And it's not done yet.
Right. It's not. And so that Uptown redevelopment project, do you think it's serving all of the town's citizens?
Yeah, I do. The Trail East project that you might be referring to that will be starting as soon as the plans are approved and the money's accounted for, we'll bring 300 or so employees to downtown every day, Monday through Friday. That brings sales and beverage tax revenue to the restaurants and beverage places downtown. Well, there's not a direct line from employees downtown to everybody in Normal. Everybody does benefit.
Carrying down that stream of thought there, let's talk about economic development. How do you think the town is doing in that respect?
I think they're doing as good as they can on their own. I know that there are the Economic Development Council, Bloomington Normal Advantage, the Chamber of Commerce, a whole host of organizations that are tied to making Bloomington Normal and McLean County a destination for businesses. There's work to be done. I haven't seen as much out of Bloomington Normal Advantage, BN Advantage, or EDC as perhaps they would like to also have happened by now. I know it's been almost a year since Kyle Hamm left as director of EDC. There may be some reorganization happening that I'm just not privy to, and that's getting in the way of progress. But I have hope.
The town, we know, invests in BN Advantage and the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. So are they effective, even though maybe they haven't made as much progress as you'd like to see so far? Are they effective so far in what they have done?
Are we getting our money's worth? I can't say for certain that we are yet. I believe that we probably are, or the town wouldn't be continuing to fund them to whatever level they are. I would suspect, though, that if we don't see some more progress soon, that funding may diminish.
Is there any projects that you would like to see them take on? Like, is there anything in your mind that they're not doing yet that you would like to see done?
I'm going to leave that up to them, since they're the experts.
There's been some criticism about what's been described as giveaways to organizations like Brandt and Rivian. What do you think about business incentives?
I don't think that we've given anything away to Rivian. If people go back and read the agreement, you see that Rivian doesn't get anything until they perform up to specific goals. So if I've earned something and I'm rewarded with what I've earned, that's not a giveaway. I earned that. Same with Rivian.
How would you judge economic development projects before the council when a town tax break is on the table?
Well, on its merits, I think each project needs to be looked at specifically as its own entity. Tax breaks in and of themselves aren't a horrible thing. If they can be avoided, let's avoid them. If it's the cost of doing business anywhere, and it means that we lose an opportunity to someplace else, then it's an investment. It's not a tax break.
So one recent example is the Trail East project in Uptown Normal, like we spoke about earlier. What are your personal opinions on this project?
I'm excited about it. As I said earlier, around 300 new employees uptown Monday through Friday. I'm not sure what all is going to go in the retail space. I've heard that a food court will go down there. Yay, more opportunity for food in Uptown. The opportunity to live in Uptown again with residences upstairs. Let's do it.
All right. So then what about the three buildings that have been described as historic that would be lost in Uptown?
I think there's a difference between historic and old. When I moved to Normal, I lived next to the Camelback Bridge on Virginia Avenue, and that was actually my first interaction with the town of Normal. I appeared before the town asking them not to replace the old Camelback Bridge because that was truly historic. It was one of two in the state of that configuration. Clearly, they didn't follow my lead, but they listened. There are components, elements of the old bridge that were incorporated into the existing bridge. It's safer. It's actually a destination spot on the trail. I think that the developers can follow that lead and find components of the existing buildings to, if not save and incorporate, at least somehow echo and replicate in the new design.
Right. And then building off of that, if we don't start with the preservation of what are now considered old buildings, how do we eventually get to creating and maintaining historic buildings?
Okay. In terms of preservation, historic preservation, we have a historic preservation commission, and they are advisory to the town council, as is the planning commission, which I've been serving on for almost a year and a half. Actually, that's a good way for anybody who's interested in getting involved with town government to get involved with town government. There are a dozen or so different commissions that are usually there's turnover every year on at least a few of them. Take a look at them and see if there's anything there that fits your passions.
And then what about the current vacant space in Uptown? One Uptown Circle, for instance, should the town help create even more retail or restaurant space in that area, or should they be pushing harder to fill that space?
Also a good question. I think that with the addition of 300 new employees uptown across the street from that space, that any restaurateur may be a little more excited about the possibility of putting something there. I believe Tartan is kind of not holding up their end of the bargain with the town because the space is still vacant. And I know the staff is working with Tartan to correct that.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen speaking with Normal Town Council candidate Dave Shields. So, Dave, what do you think of the multi-sports complex that was proposed by a consultant in July?
I'm a little iffy on the on what was proposed. The concept itself, a sports complex, someplace for everybody in town to go play cricket, pick soccer, play whatever, yeah, that's necessary, and that's not going to go away if this complex is not built. The complex itself, as I said, the proposal, the recommendation by the company that did the analysis was, yes, this is feasible if, and then listed five different things. And one of those things was, if this happens in 18 months, that was 6 months ago. I don't think that we're going to get everything put in place in the next 12 months that the proposal would retain its feasibility. I do think there are probably enough really creative, engaged people in town that could take the information that we receive from this proposal and start meeting in a facilitated, targeted, goal-oriented session or sessions and come up with a plan that would be better for Normal.
Now, kind of along similar lines, is it possible, in your opinion, for the town to go it alone without the help of Bloomington?
No.
And then should it go forward without Bloomington's participation, or should it be dropped at that point?
It should not go forward without anybody else's participation. This is not a go-it-alone kind of thing.
All right. This particular
proposal.
So let's talk about competing projects and priorities. Another big one on the horizon is a new library, or at least a library expansion. What do you think of that project in Normal?
It's the centerpiece of Uptown 2.0 currently, and Uptown 2.0 is also exciting, but it's not going to happen for a little while. And we know that Bloomington is also looking at expanding or relocating its library. I know that some folks have floated the idea of a joint library. On paper, that makes sense. In the context of the Uptown 2.0, I like the idea of a library being a centerpiece, a focal point. But again, there's a lot of years between now and Uptown 2.0. There'd be a lot of years between now and any library expansion. I think the two library boards might be well served to get together and talk about it and come back with some recommendations.
So would you be in support of a combined facility between the city and the town?
I'm not opposed to the idea.
Okay.
I would like to see it in Uptown.
The town's comprehensive plan calls for an interconnected network of streets, sidewalks, and trails that will make walking, biking, and access to transit easy for people by 2040. Do you share this vision? And is the town making enough progress in the project to make the community walkable and bikeable?
I do share that vision, having, as I said, some skin in the game with that, the complete, compact, and connected concept. Are we making enough progress? Kind of probably depends on who you're talking to. I know that there are plans every year on street repairs, sidewalk repairs. One person's priority may not be another person's priority, but I know that it is looked at every year. And I know there are problem spots for people, especially folks with mobility issues. Hopefully they're getting in touch with their current council folks, letting them know where the problem spots are and If not, give me a call. I'll be happy to talk to the council folks on their behalf.
In regards to those projects, do you have a priority that you would like to see further expanded on?
I've not seen the entire plan, so I can't really tell you that I do or don't.
The town's comprehensive plan also has a theme running through it, complete, connected, and compact, like we just discussed. So what about sustainable growth? Where should the town place its priorities in regards to that?
I think it would be more cost effective to kind of grow in place as opposed to expanding services where they don't currently exist. That's not to say we never should do that, but in the near term, let's look at where water already exists, where sewers already exist, where power already exists. And if we can diversify housing in those areas, let's do that.
What I'm getting from that is more so utilizing developments that we already have rather than going for a new development. Is that correct?
A mix. I'd say Uptown, the Trail East project is new development, developing in place.
Right.
For instance, if you're thinking in terms of housing, if there are spots in town where it makes some obvious sense to recreate a neighborhood or re-envision a neighborhood, yeah, let's do that. I think there probably already is. I'm very certain that there is a disparity already in town or in the county between the diversity of housing, as I was saying, housing that matches household size, household income, with the actual numbers of households in various household ranges and household types. I would like to see that addressed.
Normal Town Council candidate Dave Shields says his approach to community building is bring a brick, not a cathedral. It's not up to any one person to solve everything. It's about everyone working together. Shields spoke with Mary Cullen as part of GLT coverage of council candidates.
Comes from Connect Transit. Get connected with Connect Transit 7 days a week. Riders can track buses in real time with the Connect Transit app for Android or iPhone. Information at connect-transit.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, heaving winter earth brings gorgeous bounty in the spring. It's GLT's Grow. McLean County Board Chairman John McIntyre says at the foundation of the county's mental health crisis is a lack of psychiatric staff. While the county took a step to fill that gap this week by approving psychiatric care by video conferencing, McIntyre tells GLT's Eric Stock the county is looking to take a big picture approach to attracting more mental health professionals to the community.
We talked about possibilities of getting our educational institutions, such as the Mennonite School of Nursing, maybe if they could expand their curriculum and provide services for APNs. Right now, the need is for APNs in the behavioral health services to be able to prescribe psychotropic medicine. And they are limited on what they can do. So we are trying to work with our state legislators as well to see if there's a possibility to change that. American Medical Association has looked at it as well. Expand the authority of APNs because there are APNs available. Even the codependent clients require medication. So how can that be done? So we're trying to work from different angles on this. We even talked about enticing psychiatrists who were coming out of medical school to come to this community if we could offer some kind of incentive, such as maybe helping pay off student loans.
Can the county afford that?
No, the county cannot afford it, but with the Behavior Health Coordinating Council setting up something, it is possible with our sales tax money that was primarily designated for mental health to use part of that. Now, at the same time, we have to be very careful because now we have this FUSE program going, which is going to help the homeless for housing and treatment. And again, we have to provide psychiatric treatment and more elevated level of case management service to help these people stay on track in our community, and not only continue with their housing, but continue with their treatment and continue with their improvement. So we've got that going. Now we also have the triage idea, and we wanted to form a triage center. We sent a group up to Chicago on the south side last spring to the Roseland community area, which was the old police station, and looked at what they have done with their triage center. We feel that the triage center, again, will take away some required number of visits to our emergency rooms because the police will have another possibility to divert if they find that someone is evaluated, even through the use of telepsychiatry, that they can then be referred to for service to CHS or to Chestnut. And so we want to get that established as well.
Go back to the telepsychiatry issue that Member Casely had raised concerns about, not having the personal one-on-one contact. The video is not quite the same thing. Can it be close enough to the same thing to still be effective?
We have found that it's been effective at Advocate. It's been effective in the jail system. People, let's say, of older age, like myself, were not so used to the use of technology to do this, and many people are. It has been effective. And this way you can take advantage of having more clients interviewed by having one centralized agency who does this on a routine basis with people that are certified and expertise. Now, the question came up today, well, how can we provide oversight and monitor the progress of that? And we're going to have to take advantage of our local providers that are using it now. Chestnut uses this as well. The hospitals use it, and get some advice on them, and then we'll end up getting reports back to our executive committee and to our health committee to provide oversight.
How short of a short-term solution is this?
I think it's the way of the future, I think, that was mentioned. This is exactly what was expressed in, when you go back to our mental health action plan. One of our needs was coordination of services. So we've got to get all of our social service providers on the same level on this and committed to using it, even if we have to share in some cases. And it becomes difficult to do that because different social service agencies have different needs, particular needs in some cases. But we can do that, and the county stepped forward in this case, and we feel like it could be something, it could be long-term. We may have to budget some more sales tax money in order to carry that out in the future. But I think it was expressed pretty well. You just, to cut off anybody, especially the county has we have an obligation with our courts because, we have a recovery court, we have drug court, and that's how that's monitored as well. And it can't be done if we're not providing any kind of treatment.
But is it your expectation that perhaps this time next year it'll be like, okay, here's how this went, we had success, we'll continue it, or it wasn't as effective as we thought, and let's drop out?
Yes. Yes, the answer is yes. And so that we can monitor that and see if this is the way to go. It seems like, it looks like that it is. But for a long-term basis, then we'll have to be doing more planning and more organizing and figuring out where we're going with it.
Regarding the new governor's administration that will take effect in a couple of weeks with J.B. Pritzker coming in, as you've alluded to, the state has sometimes had a difficult relationship with local municipalities, with county, perhaps asking a lot, giving less and less. Do you feel that dynamic to change at all with the new administration? Do you bring some optimism, some skepticism, somewhere in between?
I really don't. And I'll tell you why. I'm kind of reserved on developing an opinion on that, because a lot of this comes through down from our state legislature as well. And what path the new governor sets on that as far as social services is yet to be determined. If you deal on a local government level like we do, nothing surprises you when it comes down to funding.
That's McLean County Board Chairman John McIntyre with GLT's Eric Stock. The McLean County Center for Human Services recently was denied a $200,000 state grant to provide triage services because it couldn't sufficiently staff it. The county was also unable to secure the grant, but had already budgeted some funding for it through sales tax proceeds.
maybe humans are what happens when high intelligence evolves in an animal that also has hands, and dolphins are what happens when more extravagant intelligence evolves in an animal without hands.
Close encounters of the earthly kind.
That was un-f***ing believable. Oh, that was so cool.
That's on the next Radiolab. Listen Sunday at 11 on GLT News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the CH3 Satellite Cafe, the boutique coffee shop from Coffee Hound nestled inside Bloomington Cycle, serving specialty handcrafted beverages. Open 7 to 5 Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 Saturdays, and 9 to 4 Sundays, with ample patio seating at 915 East Washington in Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up in just a few minutes, flying the old style in a next to normal story slam. The first day of winter is tomorrow. It's the solstice. That means there are still weeks ahead of below freezing temperatures and frozen earth. In this installment of the GLT Gardening Podcast Grow, ISU's Patrick Murphy tells GLT's Mike McCurdy the freeze-thaw cycle can have a helpful effect on the soil.
It only makes sense. The ground you walk on in the winter freezes, but different soils in different places freeze differently, and there are benefits to the freeze-thaw cycle. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. Murph, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas.
Glad to be with you.
I have to say, I've given this topic practically zero thought prior to our preparation for this episode because I just don't garden or have much interaction with the soil in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Is the ground freezing, or is it the water content in the soil that's freezing?
I think that it's more accurate to say the water in the soil is freezing, and here in the Midwest, it's frozen for a moment, and then it thaws out again. Right now, we're looking at some sunny weather with some high temps, which means the soil will loosen, and then allow the water to penetrate further into the soil, as far further in depth and further in density, so more pores will be filled.
We're not really looking at layers here. The water is completely interspersed and mixed with the soil.
Yeah, and if you can, you know, if you kind of imagine, you know, a bunch of ping pong balls in a box and then all the space between the ping pong balls, that's where the water lies. And we know from Grow Corporate that all soils are a version of sand, silt, and clay. Wherever you live, those are the three basic components that make up soil.
So different types of soil freeze differently.
They do, Mike. And the light-colored sandy soils, they'll freeze more because they're lighter in color and they reflect heat versus a dark-colored soil, which absorbs it.
So it's not really about the amount of water those types of soil can hold.
It's just one of the many nuances that affect the manner in which the ground freezes.
So is clay a light soil or a dark soil, and how does it hold water?
Well, clay horizons are usually down below the surface, so the clay can be light or dark color, and it doesn't have as much to do with it as it does when the surface color is light or dark. And the space in between the pores in clay is very, very small. So when it does get cold, the little bit of water that's in that few pores, it gets forced out as it starts to freeze.
Is this why we see frost or freeze heaves in the wintertime? I've actually planted mums in the fall, you know, and just plopped them in the ground. I'll walk back out there later, and that root ball is sort of halfway out.
Yeah, I can tell you, like, from in an urban area where the frost heaves and breaks the pavement, that always comes after there's been some substantial rainfall, or even, say, a water main broke and it saturated the soil underneath the street and the sidewalk, and then it gets really cold, and then that shows you how powerful the forces of freezing are.
And then poor ice, that's we're talking about clay. There's not as much in clay. What is poor ice?
Poor ice is the little bit of water that's in between all of the little particles of sand or clay or silt, whatever is down there. And it also includes the early components for soil development, like dead bugs and frass, which is insect dung. All those things are down there. The difference is that the early pieces of soil building material, they're crushed when the ice develops.
Frass.
Frass.
I've learned something today.
Yes.
So it makes sense. I've not really thought about it much before, like I said, but it makes sense. There's a lot of frozen ground out there right now.
There is. Half of the Western Hemisphere is seasonally frozen, and a quarter of that area remains frozen permanently. You know, so you got your Klondike areas of Canada, other parts of Northern America, the high elevation areas, the Sierra Nevadas. All those areas have places where the ground just never thaws out. That's permafrost. Permafrost is also areas that may have not always been frozen, but have remained frozen for 2 years or more.
So do we know how climate change is affecting any of this, impacts on tundra, permafrost, agriculture?
The weather definitely has an impact in the manner in which soils freeze, how often, how deeply. And when water levels rise, that has a big impact on how water freezes at the edge where the water and soil meet.
So how does snow affect the soil? Good for it when it melts, of course.
Snow is a little different than rain. You know, it takes 10 inches or more of snow to equal 1 inch of rainfall. A thin covering of light snow on a sunny day can actually warm the soil beneath it, because the snow acts like a magnifier. And it's also why we can sometimes get early lawn diseases like fairy ring or snow mold. They come about because of this phenomenon. If it was bare soil, it's going to freeze more than the snow-covered soil would.
We talked about different types of soil. What about different locations?
Yeah, like the soil that's beneath a plant, particularly conifers. The branches as well as the needles, they shade the ground for more hours of the day. Sometimes the shade is dense enough that it never goes away. And those areas are going to freeze more deeply and sooner.
And besides soil underneath trees, what about the terrain, you know, on slopes, hills, that kind of thing?
Yeah, banks and slopes and hills, they have numerous factors that impact the exposure to sunlight, water moving on the surface or subsurface, and even how the air and the changing water levels play in there. So if the slope faces south or west, it's going to be warmed by the sun on clear, sunny days.
And you mentioned there's a benefit to all of this. Nature has adapted to take advantage of the freeze-thaw cycle.
That's the part that I find very interesting about this topic, is seed germinating is affected by freeze and thaw, because some of the seeds have to be broken free from some little case, and the freezing and thawing helps that. And then for a lot of the smaller seeds that we encounter in nature, they have a thick protective coating on them. The freezing and thawing of those small protective layers around the seeds is loosened by the freezing and thawing. It also helps damaged branches break free from the tree. It's always kind of a crescendo of events that brings the branch down to the ground. And we alluded to it earlier, when the soil freezes, it smashes stuff in there that's not already a permanent soil particle, and that adds organic matter to the soil.
So it continues to help it break down.
The cycle continues.
What about agriculture? Does it make soil prep easier, that freezing and thawing?
Yeah, it's there's a paradigm there, Mike, because sometimes when you look at a field that's been cultivated after harvest and you see the bare soil and the large clods, one would understandably be concerned about the soil erosion losses that come from rain and wind. But some of those forces actually go to work for the farmers, to breaking those clods into smaller pieces as they freeze and thaw over the winter months, so that when the cultivator does go through there, there's less resistance.
So in my small garden plot, is bare soil the best, or should I think about a cover crop?
Well, for a small one, Mike, I think it's good to keep it covered, because you could get every weed seed in town that blows in there eventually. Also, too, if you keep it covered, it's going to give you the opportunity to work on it at the earliest possible opportunity for the 2019 planting season. There are lots of garden blankets, if you will, that can be purchased that allow you to keep the ground from freezing entirely. And some of those, I think, were duplicitous to the concrete folks that tried to figure out a way to get concrete to dry during cold weather.
So not even a cover crop in my small plot. It's best just to maybe cover it, and that would keep the extra weeds from getting in there.
Yeah, and the cover crop's nice because you can turn it into the soil and you get this little boost of organic matter there. But an actual covering is good too, because it does protect the ground from getting unwanted weed seeds and things deposited on top of the ground.
If you have any questions about freezing ground or soil or anything in nature and gardening, submit them at wglt.org/grow. Next time we'll talk about DIY chemicals for the garden. I assume some caution would be necessary.
Always with chemicals, Mike, that is for sure.
That's Patrick Murphy. I'm Mike McCurdy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
Find this podcast and all of GLT's podcasts at wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Many people will be flying for the holidays. Here's a story about airplanes, the way they used to be, taken from a recent Next to Normal Story Slam held at the McLean County Arts Center and produced by Devin Lovell. Kathy Davis is a former flight attendant. She's writing a book about her 35-year career called Coffee, Tea, or Peas.
If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on and fly with me. Let's fly away.
Come fly. Ladies and gentlemen, in preparation for landing, please return your seat backs and tray tables to their full upright and locked position and extinguish all smoking materials. Oh, I'm sorry, I kind of got lost in the 70s there for a minute. Here we are. Let me set the stage. There's three of us sitting in a corner of the gate area in the Raleigh-Durham Airport waiting for the plane to pull in. We all happen to have on identical navy blue skirts and jackets. We have colorful scarves around our necks and high heels. We're putting our heads together because we want to make absolutely sure that we all understand the game plan. Because once we start, there will be no time for hesitation, no time for questions. We're stewardesses, and we are about to work one of the most challenging flights on Delta Airlines' route system. It's a fast dinner service to Chicago. It's 1973, and the Civil Aeronautics Board regulates the airline industry. They dictate what cities airlines can fly to, and they dictate the price for a ticket. So if you want to fly from New York to Miami, for example, the ticket price is the same whether you go on Eastern or National. So if the price is the same, how do airlines distinguish themselves and gain a competitive edge? With service, frequency of flights, on-time arrivals and departures, excellent handling of baggage, and the friendliness of the crews. And as far as in-flight amenities, we don't have entertainment systems yet. Those are a few years down the road, so you kind of have to make your own fun, but Delta will help you out. There's a wide variety of magazines and nice leatherette binders. There are postcards. You can catch up on your correspondence. For kids, there's little activity books and wings, and maybe even a trip to the cockpit if it's a long enough flight. Does anybody remember Airplane? If you want to play solitaire on your tray table, you can have a souvenir deck of playing cards. Oh, if you forgot your lighter, don't worry. Just ask the stewardess for a book of matches, and you can smoke your brains out between point A and point B. That was the environment then. But the number one amenity that had the most competitive clout was food. Food was a big deal. It was served on many, many flights, even insanely short ones like the one that we're about to do. So we're waiting for the plane to come in, and we're really a little bit concerned. The three of us, we've never met until yesterday when we started this trip, and None of us have done this flight before, but we're very experienced. We each have 3 years of flying under our belts, and we've done fast services, so we know we can do this. And there's no way that we are going to write on our flight report that we failed to finish the service. None of us wants that black mark on our permanent record. So one of the other reasons that this flight is so difficult is that we absolutely hate the aircraft that we're going to be working on. It's a DC-9 that Delta inherited when it merged with Northeast Airlines, and it has only one galley in the very front. Now, Delta's version has two galleys, one in the front and one in the back, which means that one person can work first class and two can work coach. But with this, we're going to have to work the entire airplane as one big cabin. Not good. The galley is tiny. One person, only one person can be in there. So we've decided that the shortest one of us, it makes the most sense that she will be what we call the galley girl. She will be in that spot for the entire flight. And it's her responsibility to cook the meals for the correct amount of time. She can't start them too early. She can't start them too late. And she has to have everything ready for us at our fingertips so that we can properly do the in-flight service. She has this little hinged table between the galley and the first class aisle, and she props that up, and that's where she sets everything for us to pick up and deliver. Now, Marie is going to be the beverage girl, and that means that by default, I'm the meal runner. There's no wheeled meal cart, mind you. All the trays are in the galley in metal containers, and they have to be set up individually, and I will run them all out individually. After takeoff, when the plane, the angle of the plane is such that we can sort of safely get up, we quickly put on our red paisley aprons and our flat shoes and get ready for action. Now, to do the first class service efficiently, Marie and I have to do a kind of choreographed routine that split-second timing. She starts out, she passes out a hot towel to each first-class passenger. I follow immediately behind her and put a white linen tablecloth on each table. She then follows on my heels, starts to pick up the used hot towels and take beverage orders. Second, then I'm finished with the tablecloths, I finish picking up the rest of the hot towels and help her finish the beverage service. So by this time, the passengers in the first row are ready for their meals. I grab two trays, serve them to the first two passengers on the right side of the aisle. Now, I've noticed on the passenger list that these two are a pilot who works for Delta and his wife, and their kids are sitting in the two seats across the aisle from them. We call these passengers non-revenue passengers or non-revs, meaning that they're flying for free. And I have found that non-revs can sometimes be more demanding than paying passengers. There's just something about the fact that it's a freebie and they are going to milk it for all it's worth. And this family strikes me as the type who are going to be a nuisance. Kids have already asked for refills on their Cokes twice, and the wife looks at her salad dressing and says, "Don't you have anything else?" "We don't." They're probably going to slow us down. So I continue serving meals, and Marie comes right behind me with a bottle of wine in each hand, and she says, "Would you care for wine, red or white? Would you care for wine, red or white?" It's not very gracious, but she doesn't really have time to explain that the Chardonnay has a rich, buttery after note, and the Cabernet is full-bodied and complex. It's just pour a glass of wine and move on. After I've served about half of the meals, I pick up a basket full of warm rolls from the little shelf and use tongs to plunk one down on each tray before I finish serving the other 10 meals. So we continue with this little routine until we've completed the first class service. So now it's time to move into coach. The seats are arranged two on one side of the aisle and three on the other. And there's a fully stocked drink cart strapped into a cubicle behind the last row of the airplane. So that's where I start serving meals so that Marie can follow me from back to front as I serve the meals. Tonight, we are serving one of Delta's most popular coach meals. And it does. It's people made fun. People made fun. I'm telling you, they weren't that bad. If you're hungry. And it smells wonderful. It's barbecue chicken with green beans and mashed potatoes. And perched on the edge of each tray is a wonderful looking dessert that I've never seen before. It's a little key lime tart with graham cracker crust and a big dollop of whipped cream on top. So I put my meals down, and let me tell you, I am meal runner extraordinaire, and I have wings on my feet. This is going to get done. So I race back up to the front of the airplane, grab two more trays, pivot, walk back to the back of the plane, and it's tight space, but I do a smart little pivot, and I walk back up to the galley, and I continue to do this, and it's almost like I'm in a zen-like state. I hear this little disembodied voice saying, "Be one with the meals." And that's, you know, that's really pretty comforting, and I like that. So I continue to do this, and around the time I've served maybe the sixth or seventh row, I get back up to the front of the airplane, and something is interfering with my meditation. There's just this little something in my peripheral vision, and I ignore it, and I realize, though, that it's the non-rev pilot who's sitting on the aisle seat of the first row, and he's trying to catch my eye. No, nope, nope, nope. Nope, I ignore him, and I grab the two trays, and I race back down the aisle as fast as I can. I put the trays down, and I pivot, and I walk back up to the front of the airplane. Well, this time, I can't believe it. I think he's making this little waving motion with his hand. Not sure, because I'm not looking at him. And the little Zen master voice says, "No, no, no, ignore him. You have to be one with the meals." But my own voice is kind of taking over, and it says, "What a jerk. This guy is riding for free. He sees how hard we're working to get this service done. He's just going to have to wait if he wants more wine, if he wants his tray picked up, whatever the hell he wants." I grab two more trays, and I race to the back, and I turn, and I race back up to the front. "Miss," he says. I, you know, obviously can no longer ignore him. Everybody heard him say that. I turn to him and smile with my lips, but not with my eyes. And I say, "Yes, sir." He motions for me to get down to his level. I'm like, "Oh, God." So I do. He whispers into my ear, "I just want to tell you that every time you come up the aisle, you have more and more whipped cream on your rear end." I had become one with the meals. So what did I learn from this experience? Well, three things that obviously I should have already known. One, don't prejudge people and presume that you know their motives. Two, never ignore a passenger who's trying to get your attention, no matter what kind of a hurry you're in. And three, always, always watch your back.
That's former flight attendant Kathy Davis, who had a 35-year career in the air. She spoke at a recent Next to Normal Story Slam held at the McLean County Arts Center in Bloomington. Devin Lovell produces the Next to Normal Story Slams. Thanks to GLT's Brianna Groh for recording that episode. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. And that is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, with help today from Eric Stock, Mary Cullen, Mike McCurdy, Brianna Groh, and Devin Lovell of the Next to Normal Story Slam. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page. We're WGLT-FM. Or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.